Hello and welcome to the Fitness Mindset Podcast with Kate Niedecker. So today I have a guest with me who is a sports dietitian who works with elite athletes. Today I am joined by Rini McGregor. So Rini, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on your podcast. Yeah, it's nice to be doing this today.
Great. No, thank you for joining me to share your expertise. So Rini, can you tell the listeners a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I'm a sports and eating disorder specialist dietitian. I guess I've got a really varied background. I started off actually way back when in the NHS doing clinical work, working in all sorts of clinical dietetic work. From, I don't know, where would we start? From paediatrics to renal to eating disorders, you name it, you kind of covered it all type thing. I did that for quite a long time. And then I've always been incredibly sporty myself as a child and through my adulthood. And I guess it was becoming more and more apparent to me that, you know, there was a link between nutrition and training, and lots of my friends were asking me questions. And although I knew the answers, I wanted to kind of consolidate that a little bit more. So I actually went back to uni and did a postgrad in applied sports nutrition. So that was my third degree, but I did that and ended up then working for the next, I suppose, maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 years in very, very high performance sports. So I went to London, went to Rio. And I guess it was post Rio where my attention started to move more towards what I do now. Although I still work with a lot of high profile sports, as within sports performance, mm-hmm. I suppose I've become more and more known as the individual that works with athletes that have a dysfunctional relationship with food and training. And I guess also, although it's never meant to be this way, I guess a lot of women's health issues as well, kind of I've sort of become the person in the know about that, which I have no idea how I got there, but but I did, so that's what I'm doing. I suppose my background, the clinical background, meant that I've got a really good understanding of the body beyond just sports science and beyond just sports physiology, which I suppose a lot of sports nutritionists have.
Yeah.
But I guess having that kind of biochemical background, understanding how bloods work and what they tell us about the body, understanding hormones and how that works, has meant that I've put it all together. And it means I can observe people holistically, like look at where they are at from a clinical presentation, a psychological presentation, and see a physical presentation. So it just means that you can kind of give them something back that works for them.
And I think that's why I'm truly grateful for you joining onto the podcast, because you do have so much experience in those different areas, especially as a clinician as well. So it's great that you can speak about things that may be out of someone's scope of practice, so endocrinological areas as well. So you speak a lot about low energy availability, and it's something that you specialise in. Now, for many listeners, they might not know what low energy availability is. So would you be able to just give an understanding of what low energy availability is?
Yeah, sure. So low energy availability is basically when the energy being taken into the body doesn't meet the work that you do. And what I mean by that is, people got to get very confused by what I mean by work. But work would include training. So obviously, if you are somebody that trains regularly, whatever that might look like, that's going to be incorporated in the work that your body does. But it also incorporates our day-to-day movement, right? So like when we get up in the morning, I stumble down the stairs to my bathroom, that's movement, you know, or like we put the kettle on, or if we work in an office where we're getting up to use the photocopier or whatever it might be, that kind of general movement as well counts as the work that your body does. But finally, it also counts for all the biological processes within the body. And I think this is what so many people tend to ignore. They just tend to assume the body's just going to tick over and we don't have to worry about it. But actually, those biological processes, so, you know, your heart rate, your red blood cell production, your tissue repair, your bone density replacement, like all of that takes a lot of energy and actually probably takes up most of the energy that our body requires. So when there's a low energy availability, it suggests that there's not enough energy being met to cover all those three areas of energy output. And so when that happens, then the body has to do something about it. It can't continue to, you know, provide the services, I guess. It's a bit like, you know, house. It's like, you know, pay for your bills. But if you don't keep up with your bills, then unfortunately some of the services get cut off. It's the same sort of thing, but within your body.
Absolutely. And there's such a variety of reasons why people can massively underestimate their energy availability. Obviously, the pressures for athletes to lose weight, for females to lose weight. So that can be one of the reasons why people do put that energy availability quite low. What are some reasons that you think that people are underestimated so greatly?
I think, unfortunately, I mean, we live in a society where we are constantly told to move more and eat less. Mm-hmm. And I understand that because, you know, the majority of the population is a population where weight and obesity is a problem. And we know that. Like, yeah. A lot of the population is sedentary. Food is at their convenience. They're probably eating more than they need to. They're probably eating the wrong types of food. And unfortunately, that does get stored as excess. And then that has its own health implications. Mm-hmm. So I understand the messages that are going out. I have no issue with that. You know, I've got friends who work in public health nutrition. I think they're doing a great job and it's fine. Mm. But I suppose where it becomes problematic from my point of view is that it's not one size fits all. And maybe some of the things that are not being made clear is that this is a message for a certain type of population, certain subset of our bigger population. And So the individuals that I tend to end up working with, they're already ticking all those boxes. They're already active, probably more active than the average person. Mm-hmm. They're already, you know, eating in a healthy way. They're already, you know, they're already getting all the vegetables and the complex carbs and the fiber and everything that they need. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, like, for them then to then start taking on those messages means that they then under fuel. I also think, and I don't know for a fact, but I also think we do seem to have a huge fear of weight and weight stigma. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, you think about the types of people that I'm working with, and they do tend to be a certain type of personality. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, there is this fear of letting go. There's this fear of kind of things unraveling. Like, you talk to a lot of people I work with, and they know they've got an issue. They know that they need control. They know that they are trying to control every aspect of their life that's impossible, really. But they don't feel safe if they don't. But the fear of letting go, a lot of people will say to me, but if I let go, I'll become lazy. Like, that's a word that's used a lot. And I find that quite fascinating because, like, what does that even mean, lazy? Yeah. You know, like, exactly. I think people have an image of what they think lazy is, and maybe it's to do with that, you know, the comedy drama, the comedy from years ago, The Royal Family, and people on the sofa not doing very much. But I don't know. Like, from my point of view, I don't think anybody's lazy. I think we're allowed to have downtime. That's okay.
Yeah.
And we're allowed to have days where we don't move. That's okay. That's also okay. But I suppose I'm a very productive person, and these individuals also tend to be very productive people. So then the thing about productive people, and I know I have to manage this myself, is that we want outcome. Mm-hmm. And we want outcome on our time frame. And of course, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it can feel like, a friend of mine rang me this morning and said, oh, how was your weekend? I was like, yeah, it was good. And she said, what did you do on Sunday? I said, I had a really unproductive day. She said, well, what did you do? I said, well, I went for a run and I sorted some stuff out, and I went to the charity shop and I took the dogs for a walk. I made some dinner. And she's like, that doesn't sound unproductive.
That's
nice. But from point of view, I was suddenly like, yeah, it's not unproductive, but from my point of view, I didn't get any work done. Mm-hmm. from that point of view. So I think, again, a lot of what we'll talk about today, a lot does stem from our interpretation of messages, our interpretation of our environment, our interpretation of the circumstances we're in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a big part of the work that I do. Is like, it's not about blame culture. It's not about saying, well, it's that person's fault, or it's that person's fault, it's because that was said to me, that this is what's happened to me. It's about understanding that you have to take a little bit of responsibility for yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of us will interpret things because we may be highly sensitive or maybe highly critical. Mm-hmm. We've grown up with a narrative that tells us that we're not quite good enough, so our self-assurance is low, and so we're looking for answers. And I think these are sometimes the reasons why people don't believe that they need a certain amount of fuel.
Yeah.
Sorry, dog.
No, you're fine. No problem. Yeah,
I think it's sometimes the things. And I think also we now live in a society where we constantly make decisions based on external validation. So we have apps, we have watches, we have different kind of programs to put in information about how many calories we need.
Yeah.
And I will say to people that I, you know, like the people I work with will always be, they'll be really proud when I say I need your information about food and energy and exercise. And, oh, brilliant. I've collected it all on MyFitnessPal, and my heart sinks because I'm like,
why? Goodness.
really hate MyFitnessPal as an app, full stop.
Yeah.
But two, I hate the way it's the formula of it. I just hate the way it's presented.
Yeah.
It doesn't help. I can't see what someone's actually eating. It's just like a list of food.
Yes.
It's not like. You know, I had oats with banana and peanut butter. It's oats, banana, peanut. It's not the same for me.
It's not the same as a food diary where someone's writing the whole meal. And it's a little bit, it's more numerically based. So people are looking more at calories, for example. For example, if you wanted someone to be more mindful, then maybe a food diary of, like you say, would be far more... conducive to someone feeling better about their food and having better relationship with food, which is entirely different with athletes, because like you said, they have that perfectionist mindset of, I want to do better. How can I do better with my food? My Fitness Pal is probably one of the worst things to give to someone who is like that, because it's so achievement based. I'm sure that there are people that do find it very helpful who are learning about the calorie density of food, for example. However, there are people who it is not helpful for at all. And those are the people who you work with. So, for example, if someone was really deep in using MyFitnessPal, you had an athlete who is logging everything, what steps would you be talking them through in terms of taking a step away from that?
So the first thing that I help them to understand is that an app can't actually tell you what's going on in your body,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, fundamentally, we're not a machine.
Yeah.
And all MyFitnessPal does is you log in some information about your body, it puts it through an equation, and it comes out with a number.
Yeah.
That's you. That doesn't define you. Like that doesn't tell me anything that's going on for you. If we think about the human body, it's constantly changing. The environment internally is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our temperature goes up and our body has to work to bring that down. Sometimes we're creating new red blood cells. Sometimes we're putting down new muscle mass. Mm-hmm. Like, these are all energy demanding processes. Our hormones all have to interact to work together. You know, like just our reproductive hormones, but our thyroid hormones, which affects our metabolism, mm-hmm. our appetite hormones, like everything has to work and everything demands energy. And so an app cannot take that into consideration. And often when I give them just that, when I help them to explain, their body is more, you know, I sometimes use the tube map as an analogy, like, This is how complicated the body is, probably even more so, but there's so many interactions. And what happens is when one of the tube line goes down, if the northern line goes down, everything gets diverted, say, to the Victoria line. So then that becomes really heavily impacted. And, you know, then but it can have huge repercussions to the system and how quickly you get it takes to get to your destination, etc. It's the same thing with the body. If we affect one area, so with the MyFitnessPal, you're just looking at the calories in, you're not looking at the fact that if that's not right, it will have huge ramifications for your mind, your hormones, your digestive system, like everything gets affected. And I think that's like the first step I take, is helping them to understand it. And often that's actually usually enough for a lot of people.
Yeah.
The other thing is helping them to understand that the reason why they need it is because it helps them to feel safe. They want absolute certainty that they're getting it right. right? That's the big thing, you know, like a lot of the people I work with are this perfectionist mindset. And if we take a step back a minute and look at what perfectionism is, it's often something that's created. It's not something that you're not necessarily born with, but it's something that develops as a way of seeking approval, right? And so you're constantly cracking the whip because you're seeking this approval and you keep collecting accolades. So in athletes' cases, they keep getting great results, they keep getting medals, they keep entering more and more races, but yet they never feel satisfied. Mm. Because really what perfectionism is telling you is that you're not enough.
Yeah.
Right? It's just reiterating again and again and again, you're not enough, you're not enough, you're not enough. Mm. And so actually, one of the things is helping people to understand that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all want certainty to a degree. Like, everybody would like to know life's going to work out and it's going to be okay and we don't have to experience difficult situations. But then that's not life.
Mm.
You don't learn.
Yeah.
You know, like, you talk to some of the top athletes in the world and they'll say they learned their biggest lessons from those experiences where the races didn't quite go to plan or the training didn't quite go to plan, because it's when you take a step back and look at that experience and go, yeah, I didn't handle that particularly well. Mm. So how will I do that differently?
Yeah.
You know, I always say to people, you never fail. You just learn from your experiences.
Mm.
And I guess, again, you know, with the whole aspect of certainty, I mean, even if everything is going completely right for you, and let's face it, we have moments of that when it all comes together and you go, yeah, I'm bossing life.
Yeah.
Fall apart within 24 hours, within 5 minutes, because you never really know what's around the next corner.
Mm.
And I think the thing to say about that is not that it's anybody's fault. It's just realizing that we aren't our circumstances. Circumstances happen to us, and it's how you respond to that helps you to move through that.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting you say that about that control aspect and also the circumstances affecting you. And sometimes athletes, just anecdotally from my experience, when I used to be a dancer, I felt very out of control of my body and my hormones. So there were, with amenorrhea, for example, so I had no cycle. And I think for athletes as well, they want that control of their body so much. Now, what are some things that you see as a coach working with people with problems with their cycle, for example, due to low energy availability?
So, like, obviously the first symptom tends to be, particularly in female athletes, will be that periods can change.
Yeah.
So maybe that initially they don't just stop, they might get a bit lighter, or the duration between periods might change. So some people find they get an increased frequency,
mm-hmm.
which actually just suggests you're not ovulating because you're just getting a shift in hormonal changes, usually in progesterone. So you get a bleed, but you're not actually ovulating as such.
Yeah.
But you can also get much longer. So you could find that if you did normally have a 4-week cycle, it could become 5 weeks, then 6 weeks, and then eventually maybe it stops completely. Obviously, when it stops completely, that's an indicator that something's gone wrong, like something's not working for you, and that's a big sign. It's a big red flag. Now, one of the things people don't appreciate is that estrogen, which is one of our big, obviously, reproductive hormones, mm-hmm. while we associate it with reproduction and you know, periods, it actually has a lot of other roles in the body as well. Yeah. So from a female point of view, it affects our cognitive function. So it's really important in terms of uptake of serotonin and mood. So again, you know, a lot of athletes who are in this place will be very, very low, mm-hmm. and they'll feel incredibly low, which doesn't help, because when they feel low, then their negative thoughts are more dominant, and then they don't know how to respond to those negative thoughts, and they absorb them, and then that becomes their reality and their belief system. So they just accept that that's how they are.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're in a place where we all have negative thoughts. I mean, it's part of life. We all have those intrusive thoughts that come and go. But when you're in a place where you have enough energy in the system, you have enough energy, levels are good, you get good sleep, you know, all those different things, you're much better placed to observe those thoughts and decide how you're going to respond to them.
Absolutely. And that must be a really key part of actually talking athletes through that, that actually if they do feel themselves more, this is going to somewhat, to a degree, it's going to normalise, and that's going to actually help with their thought patterns. But they're so, I'm assuming, they're so concerned with their performance and what their body is doing, they're not really thinking about what's happening up here. And as you know, that is, well, it's the biggest part of it. You must see that talking to people and talking to them into eating a bit more is a really big, really big part of it. So what are some ways that you approach it with athletes to encourage them to fuel their body more?
I mean, the key thing is helping to understand that while they believe their performance is stagnating because they perceive that they need to be lighter or they need to be or whatever, actually, again, another key aspect of estrogen is that it's really important for body composition. Yes. So if you don't have estrogen circulating in your body, or testosterone in men circulating in their body, you can't produce growth hormone, which means you don't get the training adaptation. So performance is stagnating, not because you're not doing enough, but actually because you're doing too much, and your body needs a chance to recalibrate and reboot and get back on track. So that's kind of the first thing. Also, if somebody comes in with a lot of injuries, you know, like it could be that they get a lot of soft tissue injuries first, which then may go down that road of bone stress and then, you know, stress fractures. Again, a lot of that is related to low estrogen and testosterone levels. So it comes back down to, if you really want to be the best athlete of your ability, then you need to think about being consistent and sustainable. And those two things are very much around ensuring sufficient energy to the body to be able to fuel it. And yes, all athletes panic. They all go into, but I'll put weight on and this will happen and that will happen. And it's like they go into kind of catastrophic mode, I call it, where they preempt the narrative that's going to happen, and yet they don't know it's going to happen. And I always say to them, well, how do you know? I just know. Well, you don't. You know, you genuinely don't know something's going to happen until it happens.
Yeah.
Or you have to, again, it goes back down to trusting that space of uncertainty, which is really uncomfortable. And it's not something I'm particularly comfortable with, but I'm learning to get better at it. But it's understanding that, again, I think we end up assuming that uncertainty will always be negative. And yet sometimes that space of uncertainty can be really positive and can open lots of opportunities. I just had the most wonderful feedback yesterday from one of my clients, the clients I work with, and she's a mountain biker. She had a really tough few years working with different practitioners where she didn't have periods and they weren't bothered about it, but she was bothered about it. And eventually she sought me out and we started working together about a year ago, and she's now had regular menstruation for the last 6 months. And she absolutely smashed it, so she took the title.
Incredible. Like,
she, you know, she messaged me, she's saying, I need you to know that you contributed to this, because her belief system, based on what she had been told previously and the culture she was in, that lighter made you a better performer. And she starved herself to a point where she didn't have periods. And we've had 6 months of menstruation. She's got a new coach now who's awesome as well, to be fair, and he listens to her. And she has struggled a little bit with the changes to her body composition. I mean, she looks like an athlete to me, but obviously, when you've got that predetermined view of what you should look like, and then you change, it can be quite hard to a certain degree to accept. However, what was really positive was when we have our catch-ups once a month, the thing she kept saying to me was, I am uncomfortable, but I can also see my performance is improving significantly every single month. And I'm consistent. I'm not getting ill. I'm not getting injured. I'm not getting tired. I'm recovering better. And then 6 months, and she's just taken the title. You know, she's in line to go out to Tokyo this summer.
Amazing.
So, you know, you sort of think like these are the things that people need to hear, that it's not always about being lighter that makes you a better performer. It's also about body composition. And to get that body composition, you have to put the energy in to have the hormonal cascade that allows you to have that. And sometimes that does mean being in a slightly different body shape to maybe what you perceive is normal. But if you get the performance and you get the outcome you're looking for, and you can be sustainable as an athlete for the long term, mm-hmm. that's much more important. The difficulty is you have to trust the process. And that's where a lot of people get stuck. Like, I get emails every day going, I've done everything you said for 2 weeks and nothing's happened. And it's like,
it's just 2 weeks. Yeah.
For some people it can. Yeah. Depending on where they start, it can take anywhere between 3 months to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And the body, it depends on how severely the body's been depleted, deprived, where it started, what it started from, what the relationship with food is like along the way. Like, it's so independent. Like, everybody is so different. And that's why when people message me and go, well, how long's it gonna take? I don't know, is the answer. I just don't know.
You must get a lot of impossible questions on social media about these things, because it is never one size fit all fits all, because there's so many variables to the way a female body works, mainly as well, which is why you specialise in making that content that is, somehow you do it, that's accessible for people to read, that isn't making it one size fits all. So when it comes to a woman's cycle, for example, perhaps even if they're an amateur athlete, a professional athlete, what are some times in the cycle that people can really see an increase in performance, should they have a normal fluctuating cycle, for example?
So generally speaking, you're at your best in your follicular phase, which is obviously from day one of your menstrual bleed. Mm-hmm. Until about ovulation, roughly. So, I mean, obviously, again, everybody's slightly different. And obviously, the first couple of days of your period, you might not feel like smashing it, because you just feel a bit tender and a bit sort of, you know. But we know that probably from roughly about day 4, 5, 6 onwards, up until maybe day 10 or 12, you're probably at your best in terms of the types of training you can do. Like, if you're somebody who's in the gym, you'll probably find you lift better at this point. If you're an endurance athlete, you'll probably find you can push a little bit harder, you can do those interval sessions, and you can smash it on the track. You know, it's that they're the times, and a lot of that is not just because I think people go, well, why was I great today, and then like following week I was rubbish. It's like, it is hormonally related.
Yeah,
it tends to be when the hormones actually all quite low. Mm-hmm. In general, that you tend to find that you're at your best to a certain degree, and then it all changes. You know, post ovulation, you go into luteal phase, and everything kind of changes. And yeah. And it's probably the most erratic time of a female. You know, and you know, I did a talk last week on this, and there are a few partners in the audience, and I said, this is not the time to ask your partner if she wants to go away with you to race or something. This is not the time she'll be around. If you want a good positive answer, ask her in the follicular phase. And I got a few messages back from the guys going, thanks for that tip. Yeah. It genuinely shows that we can become quite erratic in that second half of our cycle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the time I get the most messages saying, I just really don't feel like going to the gym today. I really am struggling to find the motivation right now to get there. Do you recommend, actually, from a training perspective, that people periodize that and actually program their training around that somewhat?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I work with a coach, and we do that, exactly that. So yeah. He, you know, I spoke to him, I started working with him about last April. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, like, I know my cycle incredibly well, and I know my body really well, because it's something I've been tracking for a very long time, and mm-hmm. something I've been aware of in terms of the effort and my recovery and my ability. And I said, but I'm really interested to see if you pick up on it.
Yeah.
So I didn't tell him where I was in my cycle for the first few months. And I just got him sort of make notes every week in our training sessions. And then I would give him feedback on my run sessions. And he's worked it out now. He knows exactly. And so there is definitely, so in that kind of luteal phase, the beginning of the luteal phase, I'm personally quite strong in. But towards the end of that phase, just before my period's about to start, mm-hmm. I'm useless. I can't balance.
Absolutely.
I can't lift anything.
Yeah.
I just can't do anything. Yeah. I tend to just have a really chilled out session during that. And also that all my runs will be just easy. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about anything too. Maybe that would be the time when I'd actually go out and do probably quite a slightly longer run, but just go really steady and slow because I can. But we wouldn't put any sort of I wouldn't put any sort of marathon pace in it or anything like that. It would just be steady. So yeah, I tend to personally, with the help of my coach, and I've obviously got knowledge and I've had run coaches previously. So with the help of my coach, I tend to manipulate my training depending on where I am in my cycle. Mm. And that's interesting as well, because my cycle's not 28 days on the dot. You know, my cycle tends to shift a little bit. So sometimes it's 24 days, sometimes it's 29 days, which is, again, really normal. And I want people to know that, that it's normal. But if you start to tune into your body, you can start to roughly work out when you're ovulating, when you're probably feeling, like even just looking at things like your heart rate, for example. So I know that in the luteal phase, my heart rate rises. So the same effort will feel a lot harder and my heart rate will be a lot higher. My temperature changes, like everybody's does. And so I get a lot more sweaty. Like I find that I sweat, even in a, you know, in a gym environment in the middle of winter, I still sweat a lot more because I know where I'm at. So I think understanding your body and tuning in, it comes back down to, if you tune into your internal cues rather than always looking for external cues, you can actually respond to your body really, really well.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to say that as well, from a hormonal perspective, from a holistic perspective, because there is such a huge emphasis, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, on energy in, energy out, move more, do less for weight loss. But actually being aware of these little changes as a woman can actually help you with your progress and actually help you with your health, which is the number one thing that people want to do in the first place. But we've got quite far away from that and in saying to people, energy in, energy out, unfortunately. Now you said a little bit about times that when people are stronger in their training. How would you, for example, maybe periodize someone's an athlete's nutrition maybe around their cycle?
So a lot of the work I do will be around, especially from a cycle point of view, will be probably preparing them if they've got big races more than anything else. Like, we know again that during that luteal, that second half of the phase of the, of the cycle, that luteal phase, carbohydrate requirement does seem to go up significantly, and it seems related to progesterone. Progesterone rises, it tends to cause this uptake in using more carbohydrate for fuel generally. So in the follicular phase, we don't, we still need carbs, but we don't need them as, I suppose, not, you do need them, but you don't, that your body doesn't rely on them in the same way. You can do a lot more fat. You can use a lot of fat for fuel. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be eating carbs. Exactly. I just want to make that really clear. It's just that your body is much better at using fat for fuel, so you're more stable.
Yes.
But in the second half of the stage, you can't. Like, your body, it doesn't even use internal stores of carbohydrate particularly well. It relies on those external stores that you're, you know, the external feeding that you're doing. So particularly, I tend to work with individuals then when, if they've got a race around this time, because especially with an endurance race, you may have set yourself, well, I've always taken 30 grams of carbs per hour on a bike or whatever. But it, during this point in your cycle, that won't be enough. You'll probably have 60. And it's about helping them to understand you're responding to what's going on for you. If you want to get the same outcome, you're going to have to put the fuel in the right way. And that can be quite challenging for some people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, I'm really pleased as well that you did emphasise about, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't eat carbs at that point. And since there is a lot of articles, for example, about high fat diets for endurance runners and endurance athletes, do you find that a lot of people come to you saying, oh, well, I found this research actually on high fat diets and I found this and they say it's beneficial? Do you see that quite a lot? Do you see a rise in it?
Yeah, a lot. So what I find fascinating is that usually when someone comes to me with problems, we've got their bloods, I've got their form, so I've got their like nutrition and training diary in front of me. I don't know anything else about them usually until they turn up. But before they've even turned up, I can probably guess the story because of what I see in front of me. And the key things I'm seeing a lot of is, low carbohydrate diets. So a lot of females doing not quite keto, but definitely low carb, high fat. But also a lot of fasted training, particularly HIIT training, in a fasted state.
Yeah.
And I guess these are the two of the biggest issues towards regulating hormones. So first thing is really important to understand, and there's really good evidence, and it has been since about 1989, is that carbohydrate is really important for the hypothalamic pituitary axis for females in particular. Mm-hmm. Not so much for men, but definitely for women. It does seem to be impact males, particularly athletic males, but in women of all, you know, all populations, whether you are really athletic or not, carbohydrate is really important for stimulating hormonal regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So the minimum amount of carbohydrate I would recommend for any female is 3 grams per kilogram of body weight. Like, that's the lowest you should ever go. Any lower than that and your body is going to struggle, to be fair. When it comes to fasted training, obviously the issue being that often it's done first thing in the morning, when your cortisol levels are really high, so cortisol being a stress hormone, and then you go and do a really hard HIIT session. Sorry, I'm sitting water.
No, go for it. Absolutely. You've been talking so long.
You go and do a really hard HIIT session, and let me drink some water.
No, you go for it. Take your time. Absolutely. But I think as well, there is a lot of emphasis on HIIT training, for example, first thing in the morning before people go to work, no breakfast because they haven't had time, and then they hit a really hard HIIT session. And like you were saying, that's probably one of the worst things that you could do.
Yeah, because like I said, you know, your cortisol level is really high. You then go and do this HIIT session where you're really pushing your body hard, so you increase cortisol even further. Mm. Now, if you do that as a one-off, your body can probably get away with it.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it repeatedly, day after day after day,
yeah,
it's going to have a negative impact on your hormones. Because if cortisol is chronically high, then it will prevent your hypothalamus from working efficiently, which means, you know, it won't allow the pituitary gland to produce luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, etc. So you won't get a period. The difficulty obviously being that if you then have a female who's on the pill, she won't know.
No idea, absolutely. Which brings me on to actually very nicely to my next question for you. And we've spoken a lot about amenorrhea, about having a normal cycle. Now, how does the pill affect a woman in training, or an athlete in training, and their nutrition as well?
So if we think about what the pill is contraception, right? That's the whole point of it. That's why it was produced in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does, it basically stops ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, then you're not going to get those normal fluctuations that you would get if you were not on the pill. So to a certain degree, it does standardize everything for you. I suppose it makes you more like a man to a certain degree from a training point of view. That said, obviously, still, you can put your body into low energy availability, and you would not know about it because you have this withdrawal bleed. It's not a period, even though people say they think it's a period, it's not a period, it's a withdrawal bleed.
Mm-hmm.
So you will still have this withdrawal bleed, so it disguises that something else is actually going on for you.
Mm-hmm.
So often when the people that contact me are often women who have been on the pill for years and years and years. They've decided to come off because maybe they want kids, maybe they want to see where they're at or whatever it might be, and they don't get a period. And they get told, oh, it's because you've been on the pill. There is no such thing as post-pill amenorrhea.
Really okay? Interesting, because I was told that about myself. I was told I had it. Yeah. I was just a dancer in training who wasn't eating enough. So, you know, it's really interesting you say that. Sorry, carry on.
So, I mean, it may take maybe 4 to 6 weeks mm-hmm. to think, go back to normal, mm-hmm. but beyond that, it shouldn't do.
Yeah.
So if beyond that you're still not getting a period, it would suggest that there's still some sort of barrier, whether that's just your body's still in kind of low preservation mode because it's still adjusting, mm-hmm. or that your estrogen levels are so low because you've been depleted for such a long time and it's going to take time for them to come back up. Like, it can be a number of things. Or it could be, like, I get a lot of women who say, yeah, but my weight's normal, I'm training, I must be eating okay because my weight's normal. Remember that if you are in low energy availability, your metabolism will be downregulated. So your weight will probably will stay the same. You don't always lose weight. Mm-hmm. The body has to hold on to energy, and it stops you from losing weight. Yeah. Because it's prioritizing the energy for the movement that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So again, lots of women tend to panic, thinking, well, if I eat, I'm going to suddenly put on weight. But actually, often what happens is that the system, the metabolic rate just reboots. Yeah. And actually, you may put on a kilo or two initially, just kind of water changes and everything else, but it settles down and nothing awful happens. Unless, of course, your body needs you to be naturally at a slightly higher set point, because that's where it wants you to be to work optimally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard for people, because if they've got a weight they feel they should be, because that's what they believe they should be,
mm-hmm.
but actually their body wants to be 2 kilos heavier because that's where it works more efficiently.
Yeah.
It's a process of trying to accept that and understand that that's where your body's healthy. So you might prefer being there, but your body's healthy there, and it's making that decision. So with the pill, I mean, there's some new evidence coming through. Kate Ackerman in Australia is doing a lot of work mm-hmm. on the pill, and she's done a lot of kind of comparisons of women on the pill and women athletes not on the pill. And then there does seem to be some discrepancies, in the sense that definitely the pill doesn't protect you against bone health.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of women are put on the pill from a bone health point of view, but it doesn't protect you against your bone health. So if you've already got poor bone health and you've got amenorrhea, going on the pill is not going to change that. Mm-hmm. It's potentially could make it worse, to mm-hmm. be fair.
There's so much misinformation about women's cycles, about the pill, that women are almost, in a way, we're kind of kept in the dark about our own bodies. So it's really exciting to hear that you say there is more research coming through, and hopefully there will be more and more research about female athletes. Do you think there is going to be more research in this area about females, a female cycle, for example, in relation to sports nutrition and athletes?
Yeah, definitely. Actually talking to a friend of mine who's a PhD student in Australia, and that's what her research is probably going to be. So there's a lot more coming out. I think the thing is, women have been ignored for quite a long time because actually we're quite complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From a whole point of view. Yeah. But I think trying to get 200 odd athletes at exactly the same point in their menstrual cycle to be able to test something is pretty much impossible.
So difficult. Yeah.
So I understand why we've been ignored, but I think it's great that more and more women are speaking out about, you know, especially like high profile women like Dean Asher Smith,
mm-hmm.
And now Chelsea, you know, ladies Chelsea Football Club, they're also periodizing their training around menstrual cycle. So I think it's brilliant that more and more women are starting to talk about it. I think it was Simone Biles, wasn't it, from Rio, who said, mm-hmm. I had really, really bad performance because it was the first day of my period or whatever. So, you know, I think it's great that we're not, the P word is no longer taboo. I don't have any taboo talking. Yeah, I don't have any problem talking about periods because I think it's we are, right? It's part of us. But people still really struggle with it. And I think coaches are getting better as well. I know I've got a male coach and he has no issue me talking about my period. And I'll happily say, you know, actually, I'm feeling a bit crap or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And he has no issue with it. He doesn't get squeamish. He doesn't get I don't want to know about it. But I think that conversation is so important.
Absolutely. And I've seen male coaches as well taking more of an interest and saying, Kate, how do you coach females like this then? And how do you talk to them about it? And it must be difficult for them to speak to their clients about it too. But because there are more women speaking about it naturally to their coaches, especially in terms of amenorrhea, which, like you said, is incredibly important. But for the horrific thing that you said is that people were told that that was normal, that it was normal for them to experience amenorrhea as an athlete, which is what I've heard countless times before. And as you said from your success story is, look, I've got a client who's actually performed even better with periods. So if you can keep spreading that word, if people can keep talking about it, then that's the aim, really. I mean, would you say that's your aim in the sports industry, to keep speaking about these things, to keep educating people about these things so it isn't a taboo?
Yeah, I think my philosophy has always been about creating sustainable athletes. Yeah. And you can only create a sustainable athlete if they are healthy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a there's a misconception that you need to focus on performance over health. But unless you have an athlete's health, you're not going to get performance. Mm-hmm. And it's also one of the reasons I walked away from very high performance sport, because athletes weren't, they weren't looked after. Mm-hmm. They weren't, you know, it was all about their performance, and it didn't really align with my,
with your ethos, really.
Yeah. And with my core values. And I found it more, I found it more and more uncomfortable working in that environment, thinking, no, this is not what I want to be about. And actually removing myself from that environment and setting up the work that I do now, the clinics that I've done, the Train Brave podcast, everything I've done, there was never an ulterior motive. It was never like I want to change the world or anything like that. That was not part of the plan. It was just, I genuinely care about people. Like I don't like people suffering.
Yeah.
I don't think people need to suffer. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to create a space, particularly for athletes who are often mismanaged and misunderstood, that meant they could come to the clinic and they could talk openly without fear that they were going to be struck off a team or they were going to be told to pull their socks up or whatever. I wanted them to be able to talk openly. And I also wanted to give them a place where we could look at them as a whole. So we do their blood tests, we do their bone density, we look at their training load, and we manage it if we need to. If we need to do different types of training, then we've got people at hand that can help them do that. You know, we look at where their relationship with food is, we look at where their relationship with themselves is, and then we put them back together again with the intention they go back into their sport much more robust and resilient and able to do what they do, just like the, you know, the mountain biking athlete that I've just spoken about. You know, like for me, she committed to the journey and the outcome has occurred. And you know, I could say that about countless people I've worked with. And I'm just, it's for me, it's never about, I think sometimes, particularly in elite sport, there's a lot of egos. Mm-hmm. People want to be associated with getting that medal, and so they will change their practice because they want to see that they're fitting into that outcome.
Yeah.
And I've never wanted to be that person. I don't care if I don't get mentioned in messages or like posts. I quite like a quiet life, to be honest.
Yeah.
But for me, giving somebody back the passion for their sport to do well, that's what I was about.
Absolutely. And seeing more females have longer careers, I think, as well, is amazing, because there's so many females that do leave their careers, and which kind of brings me on to my next question, which is a little bit of a selfish question, just because I used to be a dancer and I know that you work with dancers. So how do you find it working with dancers, which aren't really classed as athletes, but in my opinion they are?
The athletes, I mean, they probably have more discipline and kind of training than most. Absolutely. Most high level athletes, to be fair. It's a really interesting question. I went into working with ballet, tried to go in with an open mind, because obviously there is this kind of stigma attached.
Absolutely. To it. Yeah. You have a big job ahead of you.
And I'll be honest, I've been really fortunate, I think. Like, going into Scottish Ballet, Scottish Ballet is definitely a ballet company who have got their head screwed on and have got the future of their dancers as a forefront. Like, it's really important to them. And so I'm very, very lucky that my clinical lead there, who I work with, he talks to me about everything, and he wants their health. Like, he can see the link between the female athlete, the female dancers not having periods, and that having then causing repetitive injury, because he's the lead physio as well. So he's there hands on. The same with the guys. He can see that they're not getting their body composition gains if they're not fueling correctly. And so actually going into that environment was nowhere near as difficult as I thought it was going to be. And I think the culture within dance is changing. You know, I think slowly, there's always going to be, like with every sport, there's always going to be old school coaches that believe a certain thing.
Yeah.
But I do think it is starting to change. And I can genuinely definitely say from the Scottish Ballet point of view, there is a lot of change and we are doing some really great stuff. And it's actually quite an exciting time to be working in dance. But yeah, there's still a lot of people that believe that they should live on lettuce leaf a day and still then do 8 hours of dancing a day, which is not appropriate.
Yeah, from experience, it's absolutely mad. but, you know, if the industry is changing in that positive direction, then that is fantastic. And it's a testament to your work. It's a testament to the work of many other professionals in, you know, broadening that conversation about females and their performance, really. So, Rini, you've written a really amazing book. So you've written Training Food. So can you tell me a little bit about your book?
So that was like a long time ago now. That came out 5 years ago, which is a long time ago. But yeah, Training Food is very much, it was just meant to be a really practical book.
Yeah.
Like, I had never ever thought I'd write a book. It wasn't on the cards. I remember I was working with wheelchair fencing and wheelchair basketball going into Rio. Sort of that was kind of, we were in that cycle. And I got approached by a publishing company a few years before, and they'd said, we really like the work you do. I was writing for quite a few magazines at the time, and they're like, we really like work you do, we really like how you make sports nutrition so practical, and there's nothing like this out there. What do you think about writing a book? And I honestly, Kate, thought it was a hoax, and I didn't respond to the email. I was
Like, imagine if you'd ignored it and just been like, it must be spam.
Honestly, I just thought, yeah, whatever. And I was actually going off to Nepal for my own little running adventure.
Yeah.
So I just forgot about it. I just went off my thing, came back and I was checking my emails, and there's another email from this, and thank God she persevered, from editor saying, I just wonder if you got my last email, we're really interested in talking to you. I was like, okay. So I looked up the publishing company, like, oh God, it's actually a legitimate publishing company, like, believe it. I gave them a phone call, and we arranged to meet the following week for lunch, and we just basically started talking, and they're like, yeah, we really want to work with you, we think exactly what we're looking for, you know, the good thing is you are writing already, so we know we like your writing style, and you've got the knowledge there, and you're credible, and also you've been working with elite level athletes, and we kind of wanted that. And that's kind of how Training Food came about. And you know, it was a labor of love. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's very much about trying to get people to understand how the body works, what the body requires. I mean, if I'm honest, I think probably, and I know that Nourish have been in touch and we need to get onto it, we probably need to update it a little bit now, because 5 years in sports nutrition,
it's
moves
science,
on quite quickly.
It's every day. Yeah, exactly. That's normal. Yeah.
Still, a lot of it does stand true, which I'm really proud of, because it's one of those books that hopefully will always think. There'll be a few up-to-date studies and things like that, but generally speaking, it stands true. And so and it's really lovely when I get people's feedback and people send me pictures of the recipes they've done, and it's really nice. Like, I never thought that it would be I'm not a popular person, so I didn't, you know, I'm not a celebrity, so I didn't think it would ever get the respect it does. But a couple of weeks ago, I was talking at the National Running Show in Birmingham, and I walked in, and I was like, a friend came with me because she wanted to hear me speak. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be speaking on that stage there. And she said, Rini, have you seen it? I was like, what? She said, it's packed. They're all waiting for you. For me, they're waiting for the person like before me. It's fine. By the time I go on stage, like, but it was rammed.
Yeah.
Honestly, I couldn't quite get my head around it at all. So I feel very, very humbled. I feel incredibly fortunate that people are so kind and have supported me. You know, I know I've got some real diehard fans, which I you know, it's very, very sweet, because fundamentally I'm just another person. I'm just a human being that likes my job, thankfully, and tries to, you know, just tries to make it useful for people. That's fundamentally what I try and do.
making it accessible for people, which is what I think you do so well, is that you make it very, very practical, very simple, and actually kind of not beating around the bush with things, which is really important. I think it's what people need to hear, which is fantastic. So really with that, how, if people have enjoyed listening to what you've brought to the podcast, where else can they find you? Because I know you've got an amazing podcast as well, Train Brave, and also you've got all your social media platforms. So where can people find you?
Yeah, so the Train Brave podcast is fairly new, but we are launching episode 6 this week, which was very much kind of ongoing from the Train Brave campaign, which I started about 14, 15 months ago. And the first year, the first 12 months, I went around the country doing talks, but basically got to the point where I just couldn't manage that and my day-to-day work life. So yeah. I wanted to be, again, as accessible as I could be and give people something resourceful to use. Mm-hmm. And so I've teamed up with actually my coach, Chris Hendy, who has got a really great background in strength and conditioning and working with endurance athletes particularly. Right. And his wife, Polly, actually had Reds. And so they've been on their own little journey. And, you know, it's really exciting because they've been on their journey because they wanted a family and they've just had baby George, who's 6 weeks old. Yay. So it's really cool because it feels like it all fits really, really well. So yeah. Chris and I do the podcast every week, and there's loads of information. We've covered Reds, we've covered eating disorders, we've covered return to play, so how you return back to training after hypothalamic amenorrhea or after injury. So we've covered things like that. We've done a Q&A where we've gone Ask Train Brave and we've answered as many questions as we can. So we're kind of using that format. So there's lots of new, really great topics coming up ahead of that one. I have my website, which is reenymcgregor.com, and there's lots of information on there and also how to contact me. And we've got some good blogs and resources on there as well. And obviously my Instagram is r_McGregor, which is probably where I do most of my education. So
yes.
It really is very much my education platform. It's where I don't really put anything personal on there. Mm. Like you might get a little bit about my running, but you won't get anything private or personal. It's very much educational, just to help people as much as possible.
Yeah, it's very good. I really do recommend that people do give Reenie a follow on all different platforms, especially if you are an endurance athlete or if it's something that is you're particularly enthusiastic about, for example. So you will always come away with some very interesting information. So Reenie, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It has been incredibly helpful, I'm sure, for so many people. So I hope you have a lovely day and thank you for listening.
Thank you for having me.